Amen. Amen. Hey, let's thank our friends for leading us in some music this morning. We got a woo. We got a woo out of that, Betsy. We got a woo. I know, right? Yeah, you. I'm thinking it was for you.
Me? Not you, Luke.
Not. Well, good morning again. I haven't introduced myself. My name is Scott Pontier. I'm the lead pastor here at Jamestown Harbor Church. Really glad to have you today. I'm a father of two. I enjoy long walks on the beach. I don't know. There's lots of things that I hope you get to know about me. But I'm excited to continue this series we've been talking about with giants. But before we do that, I want to take a little poll. And historically, when I do polls, you all don't participate. So today, you're going to participate. It's a very simple poll. It's one question. How many of you, and you got to raise your hand if this is true of you, how many of you, when you were in high school or were in college, or if you were, I don't know, really academically on it in middle school, had to read Homer's Odyssey at some point? How many of you? We got two out in the lobby that are very good. Okay, which one of you wants to come up here and explain the plot to all of us? Nobody? Okay, a bunch of chickens. I see how it is. Homer's Odyssey, all right? Oh, that's a weird. Let's take that slide off because that does not help us. That didn't work. So, thanks anyway. But let me tell you about Homer's Odyssey, right? It's the story of a Greek warrior named Odysseus, and he gets lost on his way home from the Trojan War, and he's like gone for like it's a 10-year war, and he's gone for 10 years. And over those 10 years while he's lost, he spends his time fighting monsters and sorcerers, and like resisting all of these temptations so he can all return home to like protect his family, right, from the men who want to steal their fortune. It's a classic tale of heroes. It's a heroic epic. In fact, it's part of the oldest work of Western literature in history. Right? This is a story that has endured since the 8th century BC. For almost 3,000 years, this story has been part of our world, of our culture, even to the point where people today still read it. I think that's fascinating, right? Why is that enduring? Partly because stories about heroes endure. Stories about heroes are part of our cultural mindset, and we love those things. I mean, think about comic books. Did you know that the first comic book came out like 100 years ago? And it's still today part of our culture. You go to movies and see movies based on comic books. They're writing new comic books all the time. They're still telling stories of Superman. It's crazy. Or how many of you had heroes walk to your front door on Tuesday night while they were trick-or-treating? Right? How many of you did that? How many of you had baseball sports heroes, right? Or Batman or comic book heroes, or I guess pandas, the heroes of the animal kingdom, I suppose. And one of your children is just straight up villain, right? Just Darth Vader, this the whole thing. Watch that one, right? Everybody loves heroes. Everybody loves heroes. Heroes are a part of our culture. And I think it's one of the reasons why this story we've been spending so much time in of David defeating Goliath remains so popular and so commonplace in our world today. Because it reads like the quintessential biblical hero story. In fact, in children's ministries across the nation, when you look at their outline for the curriculum for the year, there's often a section called Bible Heroes. And David and Goliath gets shoved right in that section of the curriculum. But as we've been learning, if you've been here for the last 3 weeks, we've been learning that this story that we take on first blush as we look at the story of a little guy defeating a big guy, of a hero winning the day, actually has many, many other layers to it. Layers that really aren't just a tale that was told a long time ago, but layers that actually impact who we are today if we pay attention to them. So, you know, we've been learning all of these sorts of things about that. And the first week we talked about the fact that godly people don't let giants define them. And we walked all the way through, what does that look like? And then the second week we talked about how godly people look at the story and they learn to introduce God into the battle. And then last week when we talked about this, we had this whole conversation around fear and realized that one of the layers of the story is that godly people don't let fear tell them what is true. So we've been taking all of these lessons and layers from the story of David and Goliath that that are really below the surface. And today I want to look really closely at why this is a story about a hero. And what does that mean to you and I today? What's really going on underneath that we can actually learn from when we think about this as a hero story? Because there isn't a story in the Bible that was told just for the sake of telling. There isn't a story in the Bible that was just, well, let me tell you what happened a long time ago. Every story that's in the Bible is meant for you and I to actually use in our lives today. So we're going to do that a little bit today. And it's been a while since we've actually like read the story. I've been recapping it a lot. So today I just want to read you the story again to refresh our memories from 1 Samuel 17. And I'm not even going to put the words on the screen. I just want you to hear it. I just want you to listen to what the story sounds like. And then we're going to talk a little bit about this. Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Socoh in Judah. They pitched camp at Ephes Damimim between Socoh and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the Valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another with a valley running between them. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head. He wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. On his legs were bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear was like a weaver's rod. Its iron point weighed 600 shekels. His shield bearer went ahead of him. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." On hearing the Philistine's word, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Now David was the son of an Epaphrite by the name of Jesse, who was from Bethlehem in Judah. Jesse had 8 sons, and in Saul's time, he was very old. Jesse's 3 oldest sons had followed Saul to war. The firstborn was named Eliab, the second Abinadab, and the third Shammah. David was the youngest. The 3 oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward every morning and every evening and took his stand. Now Jesse said to his son David, "Take an ephah of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers and hurry to their camp. Take along these 10 cheeses to the commander of their unit, see how your brothers are, and bring back some assurance from them. They are with Saul and all the men of Israel in the Valley of Elah fighting against the Philistines." Early the next morning, David left the flock in the care of the shepherd and loaded up and set out as Jesse had directed. He reached the camp as the army was going out to its battle positions, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their lines and facing each other. David left his things with the keeper of supplies, ran to the battle lines, and asked his brothers how they were. As he was talking to them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance, and David heard it. Whenever the Israelites saw the man, they all fled from him in great fear. Now the Israelites had been saying, "Do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his family from taxes in Israel." David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" They repeated to him what they had been saying and told him, "This will be done for the man who kills him." When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the man, he burned with anger against him and said, "Why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle." "Now what have I done?" David said. "Can't I even speak?" He then turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter, and the men answered him as before. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul, and Saul sent for him. David said to Saul, "Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him." Saul replied, "You are not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You're only a young man, and he has been a warrior from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be just like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of the Philistine." Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic, and he put on a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around because he was not used to them. "I cannot go in these," he said to Saul, "because I'm not used to them." So he took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand and he chose 5 smooth stones from the stream and put them in his pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with a sling in his hand approached the Philistine. Meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bearer in front of him kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, and he despised him. And he said to David, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. "Come here," he said, "and I will give your flesh to the birds and to the wild animals." David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with a sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give your carcasses to the Philistine army and the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands." As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. Then David ran over and stood over him. He took hold of the Philistine's sword and drew it from its sheath. After he killed him, he cut off his head with the sword. When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and ran. Then the men of Israel and Judah surged forward with a shout and pursued the Philistines to the entrance of Gath and the gates of Ekron. Their dead were strewn along the road from Gath to Ekron. When the Israelites returned from chasing the Philistines, they plundered their camp. That's the story, right? That's the story. It's a hero story. So the question I want to wonder a little bit about is, what makes this particular story so famous? What makes this particular tale something that is easy to tell again and again, that people on the side of the road who might not know anything about the Bible could actually say, "Oh yeah, I know about David and Goliath." And why do we simplify it so much down to it's a little guy and a big guy and they're fighting and 5 little stones he took and then off we go? Because what's happening behind the story is just a lot of stuff. If you read the chapters before, if you read the chapters after, this is just after the Israelites demanded their first king. Saul is the first king this country has ever had. And he's just beginning this sort of nation-building stuff around the Israelite community. And you've got all of these different characters, right? You've got Philistines, you've got Israelites, you've got Saul, you've got conquering enemies, you've got Goliath. It's not actually a simple story, but we simplify it into a hero's tale. And I think the reason we do that is because human beings love heroes. There was a 19th century historian named Thomas Carlyle, and he said this. He said, "Society is founded on hero worship." Society is founded on hero worship. It's one of the bedrocks of our culture. Think about that for a minute. Our society is founded on hero worship. Something deeply ingrained in not only our culture, but it's also true of the Israelites in this story. Because just a few chapters prior to the battle scene, you can literally see Israel found their society on hero worship. Right? So let's go back to 1 Samuel 8. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, "You are old and your sons do not follow your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all other nations have." We want a king. You're old. Your sons are bad news. Who's going to lead us? We want a king. Everybody else has one. And then after that, Samuel goes into this long conversation. Let me tell you why this is a bad idea. Let me tell you, you don't need a king. The Lord is your leader. You follow God. He is your leader. You don't need a king. If you have a king, he's going to do all kinds of things that you don't want. Your sons are going to serve him, and they're going to die in battle. You don't want a king. But this is how they reply in verse 19. No, but we are determined to have a king over us, so that we may also be like all the other nations, and that our king may govern us and go out before us and fight our battles. They're actually not just looking for a king, they're looking for a hero. They're looking for someone to go out and fight battles for them. And then in 1 Samuel 9, it tells us there was a Benjamite, a man of standing, whose name was Kish, son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Berkorath, the son of Aphia of Benjamin. Kish had a son named Saul, as handsome a young man as could be found anywhere in Israel. And he was a head taller than everyone else. So Samuel relents and finds this person to be their king. Because despite all of the warnings, Israel is holding out for a hero till the end of the night. Right? He's got to be fast. He's got to be strong. He's got to be a head taller than everybody else. They want a hero. So you can see underneath this David and Goliath story is a deeper story about hero worship. At the foundation of their society was this desire for a hero. They had God, but they wanted something for themselves, as other nations had done. Why is that? University scholar at Santa Clara University, Scott LaBarge, says, "We need heroes because they define the limits of our aspirations. We want a hero because they define for us what we want to become. They symbolize the qualities and the ambitions that we would like to possess and ambitions we would like to satisfy." This request for a hero, for a king from the Israelites, is based on hero worship, and it tells us what they want for themselves. It tells us about they as a culture and they as a people, what they're ambitious for. They want to be heroic. They want to be a head taller than everybody else. They want to be better than everything around them. And we're not any really different today. We have heroes. We have ambitions. We might call them role models. We have these things in our life that we look up towards or desire to become. And when we do that, it often turns into this left-hand turn, where the more we think about heroes, the more we found our lives on hero worship, we place ourselves as heroes. I don't know if anybody ever did this when they were a child, but I used to play Star Wars with my friends, because I'm a nerd and I love Star Wars. I remember we, at this one point in my backyard, we had this huge dirt pile. We were like redoing the whole lawn or something, and there was a big pile of dirt that my friends and I would pretend was the Millennium Falcon. And we would fly around on this thing, right? And I remember particularly one weekend where my friends were over and I had some family over and we were out there playing. And I was Luke Skywalker and my friend Dave was Han Solo. And then I had my two cousins who I made be C-3PO and R2-D2. Like the lamest characters in the whole thing, right? But why do I do that? Why is it that I can't imagine myself being anybody but the hero of that story? That I make the people around me take these other side roles because when I think about my story, well, I can't write it any other way. I'm Luke Skywalker. I'm the hero. And maybe you do the same thing, right? Maybe when you think about your week, when you think about your day, the only perspective you use comes out of your own eyes, right? The world that you view, my guess, is centered with you at the middle of it. So here's my question. How does that work for you? Does basing your story on yourself get you where you want to go? Does it make you happy? Because my guess is that you either find, if you're the hero of the story, you're the person who can either do nothing right because you're comparing yourself to other people, or you can do nothing wrong, and both places feel really dangerous to me. Maybe you base your story on someone else as the hero, right? Maybe you're always trying to live up to a father or a mother, and you just can't quite figure that out. Or maybe you are comparing yourself to a sister or a brother or a friend who's more successful or better looking or seems to have a much better social media presence than you do, and their life seems so happy. How's that go? How does that feel? My guess is it always lets us down, that we get trapped in this endless loop of making our identity a comparison game to somebody else while we're trying to find the hero of our stories. The good news is that if that's you, if you've ever had that part of your story where you find yourself looking at the world with yourself at the center or comparing yourself to somebody else, you are not the first person to live like that. Not the first person by a long shot, because Israel is doing the exact same thing in this story. They are a nation that is pinning all of their hopes on hero worship. They found a hero in Saul as the king. He's a head taller than everybody else, and now they've got one. And how's that working for them? How's that going for them? Not too good if you really go back into the story and look at this. Let's look at a couple of places in the story I just read and see how this hero worship is going. Verse 11. On hearing the Philistines' Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Their hero, dismayed and terrified. Verse 25, now the Israelites had been saying, do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give his daughter in marriage and will exempt his family from taxes in Israel. The king will give you his stuff if you go fight him. Or what about this in verse 38? Saul dressed David in his own tunic, put on a coat of armor on him, and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on the sword over his tunic and tried to walk around because he was not used to them. Their hero is not doing anything heroic in the face of this danger. In the face of this giant, their hero isn't fighting at all. He's offering rewards for somebody else to fight him. He's giving somebody else his clothes, his stuff, to say, you go do that. I'll give you my daughter in marriage. Their hero is hiding. That doesn't seem to be working out the way they want it to. And you know why? Because we, as human beings, were never designed to be the hero of the story. We were never created to be the center point of our story, or anybody else's story for that matter. When we start living into this idea that we think we're the centerpiece of the story, things start to fall apart, and we will always get let down. Let's look at how we were created all the way back in Genesis. This is what God says about us. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds in the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. God saw all that that he had made, and it was very good. There was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. So this is the mistake we make from right at the very beginning. We read this story and we go, I get it. We're in charge of everything. I get it. God created us to rule over everything. We are the pinnacle of his creation. Of course we think we're the hero. Of course we think that. But here's the important thing that we miss. The sixth day is not the last day of creation story. We like to end at chapter 1 of Genesis, and we fail to move closer to Genesis 2, where the story continues with one more day. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day and made it holy because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. We are people who like to think about day 6 and forget that there was a day 7. At the beginning of the entire world, the way we were created we are not the main character of the story. We are not the hero. God is. The whole thing was all about God. This is all his work. We are part of his work. We aren't the hero of the story. God is. And when we start to think we are, that's when our problems begin. When we start to think that we are the one who's controlling our lives and making decisions and deciding which way we're going to go, it starts to fall apart because we weren't created to do that. All throughout creation, God says, it's good, it's good, it's very good. And when we live into that way of creation, things go well. When we live outside of that, it starts to be not good. In fact, I would say to you that the more you think of yourself as the hero in the story, the more your life will begin to fall apart. The more you think of yourself as the hero of the story, the more your life will begin to fall apart. Think about it this way. Heroes have villains, right? Every hero has a villain. For every Luke Skywalker, there's a Darth Vader. For every Batman, there's a Joker, right? And the Bible uses this theme often to communicate to this kind of core thing that we have. The Bible shares with us good guys and bad guys. For those of you familiar with the Bible, as you think about Jesus as the ultimate hero in the biblical story, there's a enemy to this. There's a bad guy to this. The Bible uses this phrase called the Antichrist. Clearly villainous, right? Anti-anything is bad, right? And the Bible talks about this. In fact, Revelation helps us identify the bad guy. Revelation 13, this calls for wisdom. Let the person who has insight calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. That number is 666. That's a crazy verse. And without going into all of the revelation is like, we can have a long conversation about that. We're not doing that today. I just want to look at this verse through one lens, because I think it helps us understand David. One lens, and it's about the numbers. I talk about numbers a lot, right? Remember what numbers do in the Bible. They don't count things, they represent things. For example, 3 is often a number associated with God, with the Trinity, the Holy Spirit, Son, and the Father, right? 3 is a divine number, holy number. What about the number 6? Do you know what 6 represents? We just read it. The first 6 that shows up in the Bible is the 6th day of creation. And what was created on the 6th day of creation? We were. Humanity was. So while 3 is a divine number, 6 is a human number. 6 is about man and humankind being created. So therefore, 666 can describe to us what happens when a 6 places themselves in the 3 position. When humanity places themselves in the divine role. When mankind tries to replace God as the hero of their story, they become the bad guy. They become the villain. They become the opposite of all that God has invited us into, all that God has created for us, moves in the opposite direction. We become the farthest from God and everything he offers us when we start putting ourselves in God's place. When we start to think we are the hero, we actually turn into the bad guy and the whole thing falls apart. So that's why this layer of the story as we look at heroes is that godly people recognize that God is the hero of the story. Godly people recognize that God is the hero of the story. It's easy to read the story of David and Goliath and we think, well, if we're just more like David, then we get to be the hero. If we're just more holy, if we're just more righteous, if we're just a good guy, and when we have a giant problem, well, you know, we try to be better, that we get to be the hero of the story. But David is not the hero of David and Goliath's story. And what's even cooler is that David totally knows this. David recognizes this, because here's what he says. In verse 37, he says, "The Lord rescued me from the paw of the lion, and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine." David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with a sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel who you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands. I will strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I'll give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and to the wild animals, and the whole world will know who the hero is. The whole world will know there's a God in Israel." Godly people recognize that the story is not about them. They are not the heroes of the story. God is. That David's only role in the story was to point back to the hero. And when we set ourselves in that place, we get in trouble. My wife and my son have this fun game that they like to play these days. It's a finish the story game where they just start talking one word at a time, right? And if you're smart, you can set the other person up to say a funny thing while they're in the middle of the story. My wife and I also have a fun game that we play. It's more fun for her than me. After we hang out with some friends, she pats me on the head and she says, "It's okay to let other people talk, honey." Like I said, not so fun for me, right? I'm a preacher. I like words. I'm sorry. I talk a lot. But what is it in me that wants to fill the words with my own? That wants to fill the space with my own words? Why can't I be a person that goes back and forth and lets somebody else have a word in that story? Why is that inside of me? Because if you're anything like me, you want to be the winner. You'd rather have all the words. You'd rather be the hero of the story. But that's not what David does. That's not what godly people do. Godly people let God be the hero of the story. They let go of control. They let go of fear. They let go of their need to have every battle work out the way that they hope it will, and instead trust God and put him in the middle of the battle and let him do what he's going to do. Godly people let every single battle against a giant be an opportunity for the whole world to know that there is a God. So as we end today, I want to bring the band up on stage, and I want to ask you to do something with me. I want to invite you to do something with me and think about what you do when you face a giant. What do you do when you find yourself facing a giant day in and day out? And I want to ask you to ask some reflection questions about how that works. How much of that battle do you fight yourself? How much of that battle is about you being the hero in the story? How often do you find yourself in God's role, where God wants to be the hero of the story and you've taken that for yourself and you won't let that go? Because this isn't a story about heroes. This is a story about what God wants to do in your life. And until we become people who let go of control, that will just never happen. And I don't know what that looks like in your world. I don't know what giants you're fighting, but the band's just going to lead us in some reflection music a little bit as we process questions like, how much of my story features me as the hero? What battles am I trying to fix on my own? Do I really believe that what I want to control is going to get me where I want to go? And as you do that, I just want to invite us together to consider what can we give to God together? Now that we've heard this story, what can we offer to God and say, God, I'm holding on to this, and I need to not. God, I've been putting myself in control, and I want to get my outcome of this story, of this battle, and God, I need to let that go. I need to give that to you. I want to invite you to look at yourself on purpose, just for a few minutes, and let's give that to God together.